So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello Man fans, Ollie Man here. The sun is out, and we have the monthly magazine show for your ears. Here's what's coming up.
God, January and February were bleak this year.
It was bleak.
The only positive thing I could think was this may be the worst January and February we ever need to have.
Bedtime stories, social stalking, and sugar. Stuart Goldsmith and Tom Price are back to chew the fat on another year of being a dad. Plus,
I would argue that faking an orgasm in almost every scenario has a detrimental effect.
Alex Fox keeps it real in the bedroom, and Ollie Peart takes to the skies. It's all to come in this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and thank you for all of your enthusiasm to last month's middle feature with Rosie, who survived an attack at the hands of a crocodile. Or should that be at the jaws of a crocodile? I don't know. Anyway, Barnes tweeted us, at The Modern Man, to say, congratulations, Ollie, you have now broadcast two of the most extraordinary, compelling interviews I've ever heard. Rosie name-checked the other one, your episode Lost at Sea. Us Man fans want Rosie Mitchell and Brett Archibald to meet. Make it happen. I don't know if that's overstepping my brief, really, Barnes, as an interviewer. I'm not sure it's my role to kickstart an African support group for people who have had traumatic experiences of open water. But I am very pleased that both episodes kept you at the edge of your seat. Rosie herself has emailed me this week too. You may have deduced she's quite an ebullient person. She's emailed me already about four times since last month. And she says, Ollie, I want you to know that last weekend I ran a 54 kilometres insanely hard mountain trail race in Cape Town. 13 hours and 22 minutes later, I finished coming down the final super, super steep ravine. For the times when a super steep ravine is not enough. Off Table Mountain in the dark. Only 11 women finished, of whom I was one, and I was the oldest female finisher by about 15 years. Now I feel invincible. Now you feel invincible, Rosie. Like you survived a crocodile attack. Seriously, that will do. But anyway, well done you. Well done everybody who has sampled my and producer Matt's new podcast, The Retrospectors. Have you done that yet? If you haven't, please do it now. The Retrospectors, RetroSpectors. Pause this show now, press back in your podcast app, and please find The Retrospectors and click follow or subscribe or whatever. Partly because, actually, your download numbers will assist us in our quest to find advertising, regardless of whether you listen. But please do listen, because we're really proud of it. We really love it. It's a really fun show. It is a daily history hit, but it's not as dry as some of the other On This Day in History podcasts. It's good fun. Every day you really learn so much trivia. Just this week alone, we've uncovered the first Englishman to be deported from America, the invention of the Hawaiian pizza, and the genesis of the Crazy Frog. It's like all human life is there, with the boring bits taken out. Please try us. Add us to your daily routine. 10 minutes a day. The Retrospectors. Go get it. Now, partly because, actually, we've been launching that new show recently, I've been doing a little bit more self-Googling than I would normally do. I don't mind admitting. I was looking to, you know, see if anyone had written a review of the podcast on the internet or sort of mentioned that it was happening. And I found a link to a song on Spotify by Terry Pedestrian and The Crossing. And the song is called Will Ollie Mann Ever Listen to This in a Car?
Ollie Mann drives his car every day. Ollie drives to work where he stays. Ollie drives home where he plays. He drives here. He drives there. Ollie man drives his car everywhere.
Now, I think you'll agree, it's not quite Record of the Month standards. But I bring it to your attention because I just couldn't understand what was going on here. Like, there was a lot to unpack. I mean, Terry, I presume you're a Man fan, which is why you recorded this. The album that this is part of is called Songs I Made for United Kingdom Podcast People While I Had the Flu. So, thanks. It did make me smile. I haven't listened to it in a car yet. But what I found completely baffling was, why would you make this song and then not tell me about it for 5 years? That just didn't make any sense. The album's from 2016. Why would you go to all the bother of writing, like composing and singing and then uploading a song about me and then not telling me that it existed, waiting for me to find it? So I looked down the track list of the rest of Terry's album and I noticed it's full of like dozens of other songs, very similar songs, for other podcasters, as like Ellis James and John Robbins, Helen Zaltzman, never heard of her. And also I noticed on the list, there's a song for Stuart Goldsmith. So, later on the show, you will hear what happened when I played Stuart his song. And in return, he gave me a fascinating insight into a world that I never knew anything about. So look out for that. Right. Also this month, you will learn what a box fresh aeroplane seat costs. You'll learn what the red umbrella symbol stands for. And you'll learn why you shouldn't watch Indiana Jones with a 5-year-old. Let's go. Right, time for the Zeitgeist. Your trends tested with a man who has some news that, frankly, belongs in another part of the show, the middle feature, really, today. But I'll let you get away with it, Ollie Pitt. You are going to be a dad.
I am.
Yeah, this wasn't me telling him for the first time. He told me, and then I'm just presenting that news to you, the audience.
But yeah, I'm going
to
be a dad.
Congratulations.
Thanks. That's weird, though, isn't it, when people say that, I find...
Why? Because you feel like you haven't done anything to deserve
it. Nothing. I've literally done nothing.
In fact, I believe you said to me just a few months ago when I was talking about my pride at being a father, I think you did say, and I'm quoting here, you've literally ejaculated into a woman is what you said. That's what you've done. How does it feel to have someone else say that?
Yeah, it's lovely, especially...
I mean, that undermines the achievement, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. Can I put in a request to listeners wanting to put in challenges that are baby-related? It would be really helpful if they somehow linked in with me contacting a PR company for some free shit, because I don't want to have to buy a load of baby stuff.
Now, we haven't really got a trend, ostensibly, to talk about this month, because your challenge came from Chris in Manchester, if you'll recall, who is a pilot, and it was more of an invitation, really. He's a Man fan, and in response to your piss-poor attempts to learn Microsoft's Flight Simulator back in April, he offered you the chance to try your hand at a real flight simulator. What was it like?
I've never been in a proper flight simulator before, so I was genuinely excited. And the flight simulator that Chris invited me to was actually right next to Media City, so where the BBC and ITV have their studios up in Manchester. So that was also quite exciting because I got to see Coronation Street, so that was quite nice.
I shared a Kit Kat with John Motson in the Holiday Inn Express there. It's the kind of celebrity anecdote you don't get from every podcast host.
There's so many shit hotels around there, it's unbelievable.
Well, the Kit Kat was the one he got free from the Holiday Inn because he was John Motson, and he effectively shared it because he was, you know, he was boasting. He was like, you guys aren't famous enough to get a free Kit Kat, but when you've been here enough, sixth floor, free Kit Kat for the Motson.
There was nothing to boast about in my hotel. I had my breakfast in a Beefeater on my own.
That sounds like heaven. Wait till you're a father. You can pay good money for that experience. Anyway, right, so
yes,
yeah, what
yeah,
happened?
Yeah. So I walked in and they'd done up their waiting room like the inside of a plane. So there was loads of like aeroplane seats there. And I was greeted by one of the brothers that runs the place, the Russell brothers. He was telling me about these aeroplane seats because I was like, this is cool, there's aeroplane seats here. And he went, yeah, these new are $20,000 each. Who knew how much an aeroplane seat is? $20,000 for an aeroplane seat.
I'm not surprised by the news in a way, because there are basically just two suppliers of aeroplanes in the world, aren't there? So I guess it's a bit of a closed shop, right?
Well, you cottoned onto that much faster than I did, because I was thinking, why are they so much? That's ridiculous. And then, yes, he told me exactly what you just said in that there's not many people that make aeroplane seats and aeroplane parts.
Yeah.
And they actually had, around the whole place, they just sort of had bits of aeroplane.
Okay, but why do they bother making it all glam if this is a pilot training facility? I mean, Chris in Manchester is a pilot who's on furlough at the moment, isn't he? Why is he going... Like, he's not going to be impressed by an old airline seat, is he?
They've made it look like that. with all the seats and stuff for the public. Don't have to be a pilot to go in. You can sort of pay as like a red letter day. You can go in and go and do it.
Okay, so because I thought this was a special invite just for pilots.
No, although it is good enough to train pilots, and pilots do refreshers there. They sort of, you know, trying to keep up their hours and that kind of thing, and just, you know, brush up, because a lot of pilots have been grounded for quite a long time, not flying, yeah. Including Chris. When they all get back in those planes, that's not a day you want to go with flying, is it?
No, a bit rusty. That's a serious point, isn't it? You'd actually really hope that that training had been kept up in some way.
This is it.
Do you need any basic knowledge, or you can just go with knowing nothing?
Well, I knew nothing, and I went in, and I was put in charge of an Airbus A320, I think it was.
You never hear a pilot say that.
No.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on board the Airbus A320, I believe.
They always seem to know what to say, which is commendable.
But you didn't have to make an announcement.
No, there wasn't even a tannoy, which is really annoying. Although I did find out that aeroplanes have a horn and windscreen wipers, which is quite cool. So I got to press
This is fun, but this is like the Maddie's Do You Know version. I want to know what actually happened. So you sat in the plane, and then what? Like, can you feel the resistance on the steering wheel?
Well, hang on. Right. But first of all, there ain't no plane. It is literally a big black box, right? Looks like a shipping container, on some huge hydraulics. And the Russell brothers, these two guys, have built this thing from scratch. It's called Simulator Adventures.
So it's not actually that different to the simulator at a theme park. Like, it's on hydraulics and it's in a black box. I mean, that's what those things are, isn't it? That's what Star Tours is, right?
Yeah, those mechanics of it, yes. But when you get inside, it is technically, in almost every way, exactly the same as it would be if you got on board a real A320. All of the displays and everything are replicas. It's not like they've got a cockpit and they've sort of chucked it in. There's a guy in the UK that specializes in making replica components for hobbyists and enthusiasts, and also these simulator setups. But for them to get accreditation so that they can, you know, train a pilot, there's certain bits of it that they have to have that are genuine. And one of them is a joystick. The whole thing is operated by a joystick. There's no steering wheel yoke thing. It's a joystick.
But in a real plane, there is a steering wheel thing.
No.
I'm sorry, my vocabulary is not up to it. What's the thing they hold on to? What's the thing that jutters and sputters? That's a joystick?
A joystick in an A320. So when you hop on your EasyJet flight, they don't have a steering wheel. They've got a little joystick. They have a little joystick. And it's just there. Just the captain sits on the left-hand side. An A320, an Airbus, is all this. It's fly-by-wire. There's nothing sort of connected. It's all done electronically.
I mean, you'd never had any training before.
No.
What do they tell you before? Like, how seriously do they take it? Because you were saying, like, with Microsoft Flight Simulator, the first thing you do is crash it into a building on purpose.
Yep.
I presume they had no time for that kind of japes.
There was no time for that kind of japes. But Chris was great. He was literally like, well, we'll take off, you know. And he took me, before we went in, he talked me through a diagram of all of the buttons and stuff.
And he's a fan of the show, isn't he?
He is.
Was he excited to meet you?
Not as excited as I'd hoped. I think I was more excited to meet him.
Well, quite right.
Yeah.
He's a pilot. What do you do?
No, genuinely, yeah.
Sit in your house and talk about what other people do.
But this is the thing. Like, I was genuinely like, oh, I'm going to meet a pilot, and a pilot is going to show me how to fly an airplane. So I was more excited than he was.
I was just trying to understand the power balance. You know, was there an element? Because on the one hand, I was thinking, like, you're taking his life in your hands. You're the pilot here. Mm. You know, you're controlling an aircraft that could spiral out of control at any minute, killing everyone on board. On the other hand, he might be thinking, I've got podcasting's Ollie Peart here. You know, this is like, it's like carrying the Veep.
I think being a pilot, part of your sort of mindset has to be that you're just calm under pressure. So if he did feel any kind of pressure, which I doubt he did, because I'm the least intimidating person in all of the world.
He used to fly for Thomas Cook, so I mean, he must have dealt with passengers that have, you know, been at the Wetherspoons before they get on the plane. Like, you must have been quite an easy comparative cargo.
So he showed me all the buttons on this diagram, which I immediately forgot. So then we just went into the flight simulator. And you get in, they close the door, and Chris sat on the right, got a little screen there, and he can program it all in, all the weather and stuff. You've got a big screen in front of you. And we started off at the bright lights of East Midlands Airport. Although I made a request to change that, and we started in Southampton. So,
oh, so you did do the journey of your dreams. What was it, Southampton to
Bournemouth.
Bournemouth. Yeah, is that what you did?
It's like 40 miles. Yeah, yeah. Well, what we did, in chunks because you can kind of, you're in a simulator. The whole point of it is that you can do all the technical bits and you don't have to do any of the sort of just boring, I'm just in the air. So there was there was no point in me going there for an hour and just going, okay, well, let's just point it to Bournemouth and just sit here for an hour.
Yeah, but it's effectively like plane karaoke, isn't it? I mean, you can choose anywhere in the... Why wouldn't you, like, take off from Las Vegas and land in Abu Dhabi? What? I don't understand.
We took off from Southampton first. That's where I was getting used to it. And it was actually unbelievable. You know you're in a box on some hydraulics, right? But the thing that kind of got me, because he sort of set it up a bit and it kind of jiggled around just a little bit. And you got the throttle to the right, but the co-pilot does the throttle because the captain's concentrating on steering the thing, right? And you do it all by the screen. He's like, you look at the screen and there was a cross. So it's like a yellow line and a yellow line. And you basically have to try and make sure that you keep the thing centered as much as possible. Anyway, when you put the throttle on, you know the feeling you get when you take off? It pushes you back in
your
seat.
Yeah, the G's.
Yeah, it did that. And I was like, how the hell did it do that? I still can't work this out. It's a box on hydraulics. I do not understand how a box on hydraulics in an industrial estate in Manchester could make me feel like I was accelerating in a jet. But it did.
Well, it's a ride, isn't it? Your brain fills in the rest, doesn't it? It's an optical illusion. I mean, it's like a roller coaster, isn't it? You know, you look at it from the outside, it doesn't look like it's going that fast. And when you're on it, you're like, ah!
Yeah, but you're so dismissive. It was like, it was so real. Yeah, you were like, no, it's just your brain
dismissive. You asked me how does it work. I'm saying that's how it works. It's an optical illusion, isn't it?
Well, it was an incredible one. And then when you eventually sort of take off and you're in the air, it was like, oh my God, I'm in an aeroplane and I'm flying this aeroplane.
Which means what? Just like nudging the joystick with a great amount of care.
Nudging the joystick with a great amount of care, yes. I do have a newfound respect for pilots if I didn't respect them enough already, in that I was concentrating so hard on just keeping the bloody thing straight in that screen and, you know, controlling the joystick and just making sure I don't go and smash into Eastleigh or whatever.
But actually, presumably, keeping it straight, that's just about keeping everyone on board feeling comfortable, isn't it? It's not even like you're still going to go to your destination whether there's turbulence or you're flying slightly at an angle, right? Because the computer's telling you where to go, isn't it? It's just so that you feel all right.
Yeah, the computer's telling you where to go, but you will, and this is the other thing, there's so many other screens and monitors and bits going on. The whole sort of job, I suppose, is that you're constantly checking that everything's okay. So you're sort of going, you know, have we got any weather coming up? If we have, we'll go around that. Is an engine about to blow up? Have we got enough fuel? It's just a constant monitoring job. And he was completely upfront about it. The majority of the time, they're just on autopilot. You know, these things can basically fly themselves completely.
Yeah, but the training is so that when the autopilot doesn't work, that's when you can kick in, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I suppose I admire the most, because when I was flying, Chris was literally just going, yeah, we'll just do that, we'll just pop that in there, that means that we're here, okay, we'll just set the coordinates to that, that and that, okay, if you just keep an eye down. And I'm literally like, what? I'm just turning left. You know, I have no clue as to what else is going on. So it was really cool, and I was just amazed at how much I felt like I was in a plane.
I mean, this would be a cool experience anyway at any time of the year. And actually, now I realise it's actually open to the public. This is a legitimate trend for you to investigate, isn't it? But right now, at the moment, having had the 15 months that we've all had, you know, it's exciting, isn't it, to leave your town and go to Primark at the moment. So the idea of actually being on a plane is exciting, never mind flying the thing. Like, it really elevates it at the moment. It's fantasy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. And we didn't just stay in Southampton because I think Chris was getting a bit bored and he was like, should we go to New York?
Right, thank you. That's exactly. That's why I didn't understand. Why would you live in Bournemouth? Like, if someone, you know, came from Luxor, I'd understand why they might want to go to Bournemouth. But I mean, you could see out of your window, you could choose to see the Grand Canyon, the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
No, I just want to see Eastleigh. I mean, it's just weird. So did you go to New York then?
Yeah, yeah. I took off from New York. And this was really lovely, actually, because Chris has taken off and landed at New York loads of times. And he was sort of just telling me the like little quirks of what it was like to sort of fly in and out of there. And if you remember when we did our episode in New York, do you remember how long it takes to get when you get on the plane, how long it takes before you take off.
I do, although a funny side note to that is that despite the fact that I'd direct message Norwegian Airlines and tried to get an upgrade for us because we were such important podcasters on their flight in return for some promotion, the seat that they gave us didn't even have a window.
No.
So I was just looking at you the whole way. I couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
We somehow managed to find a seat in economy that was at the back.
Yeah.
Not in an aisle, and didn't have a window.
It was the shittest.
So they might as well have put us literally in the baggage hole.
It was literally the worst seat in the world, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I seem to remember flying back as well. There was that guy that literally just put his hood on. When he got on the plane, he put his hood on, didn't take it off for 6.5 hours. Like, who's this guy? Anyway, but you sit on the tarmac for ages, and then it takes you about 15 hours to actually get to take off. And he was saying, yeah, that's just a normal thing in JFK, that's just what happens, this is it's how it is
because of the holding pattern, because it's
yeah
so
there's
popular.
Just there's so many planes flying in and out, not at the moment obviously,
and winds I guess as well, like being close to the ocean, like it's closer, isn't it, to the ocean than Heathrow is, for example.
Yeah, it is. But the one I'll tell you, the thing though that people do actually request and want, and I found this really interesting. Have you ever seen the film Sully?
He lands on the Hudson, right?
Lands on the Hudson. It's the story of that plane that crashed on the Hudson River, starring Tom Hanks. But it was a very specific thing that happened to that plane, which is why it was such a compelling story. And people actually go to the brothers at this flight simulator and request that. So they will say, I want that exact incident to happen to me to see if I can crash land in the Hudson. And they try and do it.
Right, I suppose I should tell you what your challenge is for next month then, shouldn't I?
Yeah, do it.
It comes from Anna in Ealing, who's contacted us via the feedback form at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. And she says, last week, the bin men didn't take our rubbish.
Oh, God.
This sounds like a small issue, she says, but we do live in a block of flats. And within a day, it was piling up in every corridor. And this got me thinking, I thought I was good with waste, but how good could I really be? And how good could Ollie be? What I'm taking this to be is essentially a zero-waste challenge for you, which is a trend, isn't it? Like, can you make better use of the things you normally throw away?
Well, hang on. Yeah, well, I was going to... We need some clarity here. I'd like some ground rules.
Well, how good could Ollie be is what Anna has said in her challenge. I think that's a ground rule, isn't it? How good can you be, Ollie? All the waste that leaves your house, that's a ground rule for you, isn't it?
What if it's just like... It's not reusing, it's just not buying it in the first place.
I want you to be sweeping the floor with your hair clipping. Speaking of which, we should thank our sponsors, Manscaped.
The only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming.
And they have just launched their performance package, which is, of course, as we all know, the perfect gift for Father's Day. Imagine surprising Dad with a box that says your balls will thank you and inside something to trim his pubis.
Yeah, also his nose. Dads have very, very hairy noses. So you could get him the weed whacker, which comes in the package.
Yeah, what an ear and nose hair trimmer that is. Waterproof with a 9,000 RPM motor-powered 360-degree rotary dual-blade system, folks.
Yeah, which sounds dangerous, but it is actually brilliant.
Where do you keep yours? I mean, that is a powerful nose trimmer. You don't want to just leave that lying around.
No, keep it in the toolbox, Ollie man. Keep it in with the hammers and the chisels. That's where I keep my nose trimmer.
You can get 20% off and free shipping when you use the code MAN. That's M-A-N-N at manscaped.com.
That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code MANN. And I've proved how important balls are. I have fathered a child with my shiny nuts.
Wow, you might never have become a father were it not for the fact that the Lawnmower 3.0 had been gliding around those. I nearly said beauties there, but it was just pure colloquialism. anyway, happy Father's Day, everybody. Coming up, we're going to carry on with this fatherly theme because I will be talking to Tom and Stu. It is our annual How to Be a Dad special. But first, it's time for our record of the month, and it's the brand new single from James. I know, they're back. It's called Beautiful Beaches. It's taken from the album All the Colours of You. Love a bit of James.
Better wake up, my love. Get up. It's time. Time to get out of Dodge. That case won't fit the car. Racing. We're racing down to those beautiful beaches. Put
Now, we don't have many traditions here at The Modern Man. Basically only two. At Christmas time, Alex will make Ollie and I imbibe some form of sex liquid. And the other tradition is, annually, since we began the show in 2015, we always do an episode in which I reunite with the comedy podcasters Tom Price and Stuart Goldsmith, and we compare notes on fatherhood. To recap, we all have five-year-old boys who spookily were born within a few days of each other. Tom had an older boy as well, Wilfred, who is nearly nine now. Stuart, since then, has now had a younger girl, who's now 2.5. And now I've also got a toddler, Toby, who's 22 months. So you're all up to speed. You don't need to have heard our previous encounters, but if you'd like to, you can catch up with the whole saga at modernman.co.uk/dads. Now, last time in our episode, How to Be a Dad in Lockdown, it was May 2020, so we understandably focused on the pandemic and how it was going to change our parental lives. And Tom, in particular, was putting quite a happy face on it back then. So this time I started by asking him if, after a year of homeschooling, closed attractions and COVID tests, he still felt the constraints of the coronavirus had had a positive effect on his family life.
I stand by that, sorry. I know you want me to be all sort of, oh God. But I feel like this thing, if in terms of, obviously, very strictly in the context of my parenting, will be a positive thing. I feel like, you know, we've spent so much time with the kids that at no point am I going to be tragically sitting there thinking, I wish I hadn't worked quite so hard. I wish I'd seen more of my kids. I will know forever and ever that for that year, I saw nothing but my fucking children.
When it all first kicked off, I read that Spanish flu lasted 4 years. So I immediately calibrated myself for 4 years. Now, we're about a year and a half into that 4 years. So we're... Yeah.
Well, that's what we're,
I am preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. It was always my fear that when I had children as a self-employed stand-up, when I had children, I would have 5 years to get off the circuit and be successful enough not to need to go to Nottingham on a Tuesday night for 120 quid or something, you know?
What about for the kids, though? Because we were saying a year ago, they're so adaptable because they're kind of under 10, you know, they're going to never know any different or remember any different. And, you know, it's just like any kind of traumatic event, incredibly, that can happen to children at that age, is there's an incredible built-in resilience. Well, that's kind of true. But like, I look at my own kids and with the younger one, Toby, who's not even two yet, like, for example, he has never been to a soft play. Now, I know that like before soft plays closed, I thought of them as hell on earth and they were obviously full of germs. But he's a kid that climbs up onto the sofa and jumps 6 foot in the air. That's what he loves doing. And it feels like a real deprivation.
The biggest thing on my mind in terms of the welfare of my children, the girl, has been precisely that. It's all the baby stuff. It's all the stuff I kind of slightly derided as parental suicide prevention. You know, get the new parents out the house, get them to baby groups, baby sensory, all of that stuff. She wasn't a baby, but she missed out on ballet and dance lessons, that kind of stuff. She really missed out on it.
It's difficult, I feel, for you guys with younger ones, because that first sort of, certainly the first year, I've got friends who've just had babies at the beginning of lockdown and they haven't done any of the things.
That must be
all the
so
things
hard.
Man, when you meet your network, who we still lean on now, certainly with our eldest, you know, we made friends then who we're still pals with now, who my eldest is still friends with now. So you're not getting that grounding, and it's more about teaching parents to say, it's like when you get a dog, you know, socializing the dog is important, but it's more about the owners getting to know each other and getting to know how to sort of network and get that support group. Not the first time I've compared parenting with owning a dog.
What about like other fundamental experiences, like, you know, seeing their grandparents? My youngest did not meet his grandparents for a year.
Again, we've managed to get a positive out of that, whereby my son now has what he insists on a private chat with Granny Sue or Granny Ali, whereby he gets on WhatsApp and you set it up and it's a bit eggy. And then we realised very early on in the year, I was like, do you want me to not be here? Yeah. Do you want to? He's like, yeah, I want a private chat. And then you go away and you sort of listen at the door and they're reading each other's stories and actually developing a relationship, which I think they would have been hard pressed to have that one-on-one time without the fact that we're sort of everyone's mucking in to make it special. And yesterday, my son started having a private chat with Uncle Bob, my brother, and I've got a tripod for the camera and angled it down. He was showing him a farm that he was building on Duplo and just talking him through. I'm going to put the sheep there. And my brother's very gamely going along with it.
I'm actually really glad you mentioned that, because I'd forgotten that this is a thing that sprung up directly because of the pandemic, but is now like a crucial part of Harvey's life with his relationship with his grandmother, my mum, Karen. She's been babysitting him through FaceTime for sometimes like 90-minute stretches.
That's illegal, mate. You can't
where are you? Yeah, whilst we've been going to the pub. No, it gives us space to like make dinner, for example. And you can hear them playing. And yeah, he puts her like under the bed and takes her into a den. And she's really playing. It's not a conversation. It's actually playing and taking her into physical spaces she couldn't otherwise.
Yes.
Which actually...
That's great. That has raised the bar for both of my son's grandmothers.
I think we're glossing it over. You know, it has been heartbreaking. It's been really heartbreaking at times, especially my youngest Edmund, when he hasn't been able to see grandma and granddad. He really loves them. My mother-in-law does a thing where she tickles his back when he goes to bed and just gently tickles his back and it makes him go to sleep. And he mentioned several times, he was like, I wish grandma was here to tickle my back. And you cut a video call doesn't replace that. So there has been... some really horrible moments like that where you're just like, we're not going to see them. When are we going to see them? Not for months. It's not for ages. And you have to kind of tell them that truth. And I hate it. I really, really... That's probably the thing, actually, that I hated the most. They're not seeing their grandparents. I found that really difficult.
I think one of the things I had to be careful of, and I sort of already touched on it, I was bringing a lot of anxiety and fear to the table that they didn't need. They are resilient and they don't know any different. So when my son had his birthday, he had his fifth birthday, and he had it sort of alone, so we wanted to give him a really special time, and we did. And it was, for me, it was tinged with tragedy, but it wasn't for him.
No, because he's never been to his own fifth birthday before.
Well, exactly. And my wife had sort of organised with loads of local mates. Everyone had put signs with his name in their window. And so we went on a walk and kind of looked at all the houses and people would pop out to their doorsteps. Again, it was more special than going to a party, listening to pop music for 2 hours, having loads of sugar and falling over. It was really memorable and beautiful.
All three of our sons were born in December, January time, which is pretty bleak to have a solo birthday. Like, I do think if it was May or June...
God, January and February were bleak this year.
It was bleak.
I was trying to... The only positive thing I could think was this may be the worst January and February we ever need
Yeah, it's the nadir, isn't it?
Brackets 4 years question mark, brackets sees bird in 30 years, whatever. But for now, as parents of small children, it probably won't be worse than that.
Let's talk about school then, because our kids all turned 5 this year, all started school in September 2020. Stuart, you were saying last year you were concerned that your son, because he's not into, quote, football and Fortnite, might struggle. How did that pan out?
Well, absolutely not an issue at all. But I'm still concerned that it will be an issue when they get out of reception and when it becomes more... Like, there are little things, like there's a girl... It's not quite... I think it might be brownies. There are rumblings on the reception WhatsApp that some of the girls are going to start going to brownies. And I'm like, let's not start segregating them now. Because lots of his friends are girls. There are some boys in his class who've got older brothers and are a bit more physical than my son. And... it's lovely that they're all together. Like, he's basically having an absolutely fantastic time at school. I've got nothing to complain about. My wife did just a stellar job of, this is a naked boast. She basically taught him to read, and his reading age is incredible. And like, one of the last things they did on Zoom for school was any kid in the school could read a book on Zoom to everyone else who bothered to tune in on the school. And my son was the only one from reception that did. And people are still talking about him. He's just... Do you know, they're all like, my son is being made an example. No, like, not made an example of, but like, they're all, hey, why don't you... You know, that guy is, you know, Boutros, we call him, to anonymise him. Boutros is... he's really into reading. And other kids are sort of getting inspired and getting into reading because of my Disney movie narrative arc.
But the reading and writing actually is secondary to happiness, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. Because I remember talking to you, Tom, about choosing a school for my son a couple of years ago on the show. And of course that's important. But actually, like, it is just so much more important that they're happy to go into school. That's the thing that pulls at your heart every day, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my God. Only this morning when I dropped him off and just that last moment he turns around, just gone past Miss O'Driscoll and looks at me. Bye, darling. See you later. Bye, daddy. Love you. It's just like, yes. I skip away. Yeah. I double skip away.
I have a guilt-free day now.
Guilt-free day. And there's, you know, I'm still haunted by the occasional dropping my eldest off at nursery and seeing, you know, him weeping because he didn't want to go years and years ago. So
yeah,
it is really nice. And yeah, absolutely right. Like, educationally, it doesn't really... I was going to say it doesn't matter. Of course it matters, but you've just got to get them enjoying going in. And it is just a big... reception certainly is just a lot of playing. It gets harder. Year two is a bit harder, especially. I remember that. But he has also... you've got to kind of lay the stuff in front of them and let them discover it. And when they eventually pick up that thing, whether it's reading and writing or drawing or whatever it is, and then it's great. But you can't push it on them, I don't think. And Edmund has really discovered, he really got into drawing about 2 months ago, and now he draws every day. And then in the last week, he's just started writing stuff. He just writes these sentences. It's complete gobbledygook. It's just letters. But he like turns to you and goes, "Daddy, do you want to read my story?" And I'm like, I mean, it's literally just a bunch of letters. It's like someone's mashed the keyboard. And I'm kind of like, oh, this is... So once upon a time... No, that's not how it starts. Oh, okay, no, how does it start? So it's very hard to kind of interpret what he said.
How do you adjust your level of praise in that situation, by the way? Like, when my kids give me something to evaluate that is essentially mediocre to bad,
yeah.
Do I say, that's wonderful, because it is wonderful that they're trying, or do I say that's wonderful when it's genuinely wonderful, which is one in 20 times?
It's wonderful.
No. What you do is... You say you've really concentrated hard on that. Yeah. I'm really proud.
Yes, proud is good. Pride is such a strong thing, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. And I think there are ways to really big them up for trying without making it clear that you're like, nice.
You can
try.
Do it. Think that looks like a tractor? Do you look out the window? Looks nothing like it. It's like an egg on wheels.
There's always that slightly the scary pile of drawing and writing that is. We call it maturing, like a fine wine, as it makes its way towards the recycling bin, and we leave it in a pile.
What do you do with it? It's like throwing away a Bible, isn't it? Because you're like, my child did this. Yeah. God forbid, if something terrible happened to my child, this would be such a precious memory. And yet, I have 50 of these bad pictures of tractors, and right now I don't need 50. Yeah, what do I do? Do I put them in the archive in case one day they are valuable? Yeah,
you've got to take out a few.
You got to take out a few, and those survive in the archives, and the rest have got. You've got to pulp. You've got to be absolutely brutal.
The other thing that is interesting about sending your kid to school for the first time is that you sort of assume when your kid goes to school you're going to build a network of parent friends at the school.
Don't bother with the second
because you've already got them from the first, right? It made me realize we had actually made a mistake enrolling our son in a private nursery for so long, because the school has a pre-reception class that you can send your kids to before they start reception, and all the parents were already mates from that. And all the kids were already mates from that. They had their own clique. They had their own WhatsApp group that it took me 6 months to permeate. So I don't know if that's like an applicable tip, but like, send your kids to the nursery at the school.
We did that. It wasn't the nursery at the school, but it's so local to it that there's a big intake from there. And as a result, we definitely met lots of parents. That's a huge tip. I think that's really important.
I tell you a good bit of advice that someone gave me is, don't make any plans for pickup. So when you get the kids at 3:30... Yes. Don't be like, right, we've got to go because we've got to do a thing now. Just hang around, and you will always see a couple of people going off to a nearby playground.
Follow them.
I mean, this is the thing you have to do. Like, I was walking home, I had no plans. It was just me and Edmund, but Wilfred was off somewhere else. And some friends of his who I don't know that well were going to the nearby playground, and I heard them talking about it, and he hadn't heard. And I was like, Noah's going to the playground. Do you want to go with Noah?
Yeah.
And he was like, amazing. And then we had this 45 minutes at the playground, and then I got to know those parents.
Yeah.
Much better, because we chatted and complained about our kids together. So I would say people over plan stuff. Don't be so rigorous.
We were in the playground the other day doing exactly that. We hadn't followed some people home from school, but we had been invited to go along. And
social stalking, guys.
Someone turned up from that private nursery who he hadn't seen for a year because he'd gone to a different school down the road. And he came in and he went like, oh, hello, I haven't seen you. And he went running over to, and he introduced him to his new friends. And he said, everyone, this is my old friend, Arlo.
Oh,
and I was like, that's amazing.
That's so
exactly
great.
How a sort of 70-year-old man would introduce him at a gentleman's club. My old friend.
The things we did together.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky because I'm an outgoing chatty wanker. So I have spent all of the... I mean, I really make an effort and I know loads of people's names. I know their kids' names and their parents' names. And I'm probably a bit much. And actually, has this come up for you? My son has told me that he doesn't like it when I talk to other kids in the queue. Like,
really?
I'm a bit fun and outgoing. Yes. And I'm a bit fun. I mean, you know, for listeners... I imagine the majority of your listeners won't have met me. And if they didn't already loathe me by now, I'm a bit fun. Has probably just finished that off. But he said,
because he's jealous of you, because he wants, you're his daddy.
Yeah. I confronted him about it.
I assumed embarrassed. Like, don't talk to my friends.
No, I think it's... I talked to him about it, and I said, it was absolutely beautiful. I said, is it like, I just like chatting. It's not taking, it doesn't mean I love you any less because I'm chatting to them. Well, what's going on? And he said to me, I'm trying to make the most of you before you die.
Wow.
Oh, that's
which is lovely. But it's exactly that. And it's an honest, and it's an emotionally intelligent and honest answer.
It does hint at a troubling kind of all pervasive existentialism, which is maybe not the healthiest thing.
Do you remember? Do you remember me saying a few years ago, I would say, we taught them about death. Do you remember we were chatting about death? And I said, well, we say they turn into stars. Your great granny turned into stars. And more recently, he's kind of understood it. We were talking about someone, a relative, and we said, he said, they died. And I said, that's right, mate. That's right. They turned into stars. And he said, and then died. Is that your fetish?
That's interesting, the death thing. So at the point of time that we're recording this is the day after there was that cable car crash in Italy. So my son saw that headline on the news yesterday. And he came in and he said, oh, they died. That's a shame. And I said, yeah, it is a shame. And I was like reaching for the remote control, thinking we don't need to hear any more details about this right now. And then he said, because we've promised one of the things we're going to do with him is taking on the Emirates skyline thing in London. He said, just as well that doesn't happen to us. Otherwise, we'd be dead. I was like, yes, but it's never happened in Britain. It's unlikely to happen. It's a bit of a freak accident. He's like, yeah, but all those people thought it wasn't going to happen to them, and now they're all dead.
Good point.
God, he's really understanding this, and it's kind of, like, on the one hand, I'm like, great, because you've got it, but on the other hand, please don't think about it too much.
Yeah, he's a great catastrophist in the waiting. That's great news. Congratulations. Yeah. Everyone loves a neurotic.
That's the other thing. He enjoys the macabre thing. So, like, we read James and the Giant Peach at bedtime, and for about 6 months afterwards, he was like, Daddy, yes, like, just apropos of nothing in the middle of the day, Daddy, yes, tell me how James's parents died. I was like, they were crushed to death by an elephant. Anyway, let's do some Play-Doh. He just loved that detail.
Because he's workshopping. Well, it's funny. It's a funny idea. And, you know, fair play to Roald Dahl for whatever his other flaws that have become apparent since. You know, that idea, that's a deft bit of writing, isn't it? Yeah. The kids' parents have died, but in a funny way, so it's okay to talk about it. Mm. But also, he's sort of workshopping the idea of death. Tell me again. Mm. You know, what death is.
Well, he knows it really makes me uncomfortable. That's why he's asking me to tell him.
No, he
does. It's like a titillating piece of information.
That's not why he does it. It's not all about you. He's trying to he's trying to explore the emotion. That's what they're doing at this point. They're playing with new emotions because that's, I guess, in terms of evolution, they need to learn about fear and learn what fear does to them and learn, you know, what being scared is like. We watched Indiana Jones. Oh, God, it was so stupid. We watched it the other day. The Holy Grail at the end when he drinks from the wrong cup and that guy just ages really quickly.
Scary, yeah.
Yeah. Do not show that to a five-year-old. That's my advice to you, because he didn't sleep properly for about 3 or 4 nights.
Right, yeah.
But he enjoyed it, and he still likes talking about it, and he likes playing with the image, because it's a new feeling in his brain, and it's like a bit of blue tack. He's rubbing it around and warming it up in his hands all the time.
It's interesting. Sometimes he wants macabre, and sometimes he doesn't. So we progress from James and the Giant Peach to The Witches, and that was too strong for him.
What about making up stories? How often do you do that?
He loves that when I do that, and I find it really hard. Because
we've talked about this before. I told you the secret of how to make up stories. This has come up before. The secret is you make them do all the work. It's like an improv game. Right. You go, what was behind? So who are we talking about? And he'll say, oh, Shrek and a dragon. And you go, great. And where is Shrek?
They love it. They absolutely love it. We did a makeup story the other night. It was the first time in a while. And then Edmund started writing out a story the next day in his new fetish for writing endless sentences. And it was the same. It was pretty much word for word. Obviously, the words were nonsense. But he was trying to write exactly the same story. Mm. And that was so rewarding. I loved that. I was like, oh, my God. We had such a nice time doing that.
Because I know the things he's interested in. So he likes tractors. He likes horses. You know, he lives in a village, so I try and reference like stuff around us he can relate to. So I know how to like hit the buttons, but then I'm like, but what's the moral? What's the threat?
So
what are we learning?
What you need. Well, okay, two things I would suggest. One, as a game for yourself, let it be a game that you can try and tie things together and make a moral or a thread out of it, because they don't need that, but it's satisfying for you if you manage to pull it off accidentally. But two, world building. So I do a thing with my daughter where there is a particular little girl character who is sort of loosely a mix of Pippi Longstocking and the kid off Tumbleleaf, which is some Amazon Prime animated thing. And I've sort of and we know where she lives. She lives in a pirate ship that's in the branches of a tree on top of a cliff. And every morning she goes down a helter-skelter slide, and her mummy is there and her daddy, who's a crow called Goose. And we've just imprinted all these kind of characters. And now she loves hearing the same. This is storytelling for smaller ones. she loves hearing the same things over and over again. So she's called Pickle Pie, and I can say, "So what do you want a Pickle Pie story? What's Pickle Pie up to today?"
She's now pitching her children's stories here in the show as well.
I googled it, and there's already something called Pickle Pie on Amazon. It's some weird fetish thing, and I turned it off.
Daisy Goodwin's mum was a very famous chef, and she never gave Daisy any sugar. She was really strict on it years and years and years ago, quite ahead of the current thing for that. And there's a phrase that I read in an article she wrote a couple of years ago that just said, "Sugar isn't love." That thing of arriving and saying to your kids, "Oh, look what I've got for you, so here's some Haribo, here's some chocolate, it isn't love." And that was... it really helped us stop doing that, because my wife and I were both doing that. We were both turning up at school and going, "Here's some sweets, I love you."
Yeah.
And we don't do that anymore.
I do notice, actually, the kids whose parents have separated, when the picks up the child, always will stop at the ice cream van. There's an ice cream van, like, luring the children outside the school every day.
Sure, love.
Every day, queue of divorced dads to give...
I tell you what's love. Turning them upside down and saying, "We're going to walk home with you upside down all the way home." Like, just play a stupid game.
Yeah, we should answer some listener questions because we asked for them. This is from Neil, who says, "Do you have any advice for keeping number one interested and not too jealous of number two? We acted on someone in our group's advice to buy a present for our eldest from the baby." Yeah, that always works.
Yeah, classic.
Which went down a tree.
And the other, I don't get a sense of precisely how old.
So new baby girl.
New baby. So one of the things that I always remember being told and that we did is that whenever anyone comes to the house to see the new baby, they come to see the older kid, hang out with them for 10 minutes, and then say, "Have you got someone to show me?" So then the older kid feels proprietorial over going, "Oh, yes, I will now show you my little baby sister."
That's good.
So we did that. We are lucky in that he's just, you know, they just get on really well.
Yeah, our kids get on really well. I was actually prepared for, like, battle, and it hasn't happened yet. They fight over the odd toy.
Is it lockdown? Do you think it's lockdown? Because ours get on ridiculously well. They adore each other. It's so weird.
They've had to be each other's only friend for a lot of the last year. And I think that's what, and I'm sure there are families where that has been one of the most hellish aspects of the pandemic because the kids haven't got on. But ours absolutely got on with each other.
Neil has a supplementary question as well, which is just, how do you get stuff done? Number one son still wants maximum playtime and the usual guff. And number two is permanently fixed to mum's boob, rendering her captive. How on earth do you manage to do stuff? I have a garden like a jungle and tasks around the house piling up, plus a full day job. Tom, get
why are you
done.
Asking me?
How do you do
the
it?
Worst message. Just resign. I think the best thing to do is to resign yourself first and foremost to not getting stuff done. You are not the efficient machine that maybe you were before you had kids.
Yeah.
So first of all, lower your expectations. For God's sake, lower your expectations. And
well, raise your expectations in a different way. We started this conversation by talking about essentially work-life balance and happiness with children, right?
Absolutely.
So that's the thing.
Absolutely.
So if you value that,
who cares about the back garden? Rewild it, for fuck's sake. Rewild it and go and do some Lego. And also, I would say that, you know, one of the things I really learned during lockdown was partitioning off time with them, which sounds a bit rigorous and timetable-y, but getting to a point where, like, it's 3 o'clock and I will switch my phone off and I'll be like, for the next hour, this is on a very sort of lockdown day, it's kind of different now, but for the next hour I'm going to sit with Edmund or whatever and I'm going to do the Duplo Lego with him just for an hour. And that 1 hour, at the end of it, they're so sated. You know, this idea that they're constantly saying, can you? I don't think that's quite true. I think if you give them real quality time in chunks, they do actually get to a point where they're like, actually, I might watch telly for a bit now. And then you compound.
Sometimes you can take the advice on this show, get creative, and then regret it. I mean, I did have your kind of excited spirit in my head last year, Stuart, when I decided to do a Hot Wheels hunt around the garden. So he loves Hot Wheels.
Good.
It was Easter time. He was thinking, oh, we can't do an Easter egg hunt this year. So I went and got a whole lot of Hot Wheels, put them around the garden, forgot to notice where I'd put them. He couldn't find them all, and then I just lost 5 of his Hot Wheels, and it was a nightmare. The whole night was tears.
You just need to change the parameters of the game. That's an infinite game. You could always be looking for Hot Wheels in your garden, and you can always be adding more Hot Wheels to the garden.
The place where we're at the moment is that because one is 9 and one is, as you know, 5, nearly 6, I'm doing less. I'm needed less. You know, when they are 2, 3, 4, you need to be there the whole time. You are their oxygen. You need to sort them out for toilet, food, nappy, all that stuff. And as they get to this age, they go off and they will play Minecraft together for a bit. They will be happy to watch TV for a bit. And you will suddenly find these huge chasms of time, by which I mean an hour, where the kids are in the house and they don't need you. They're quite happy. My eldest one's upstairs doing a thing. My youngest one's watching telly. So the intensity comes off the boil. And there's consequences to that. The first one is fucking amazing. I've read a book. But the second one is, it gives you, it's been hard. It's hard. And you get the beginnings, the first few millimetres of what an empty nest might feel like. And it's, I found that very difficult. And it's made me feel very, very anxious and worried. But at the same time, it's been good.
It's validating. You've brought up some people who are like capable humans. That's the thing.
Yeah. And they're off doing their own thing. And I'm like, do you need me? No, okay.
Yeah,
and you kind of Homer Simpson into the hedge a little bit, and it's an anticlimax to it where you're like, oh, okay, and this purpose that has been everything for me for the last 8 years is coming off the boil a bit, and I'm not complaining about this. I'm just saying it's put me in I'm in a very different headspace at the moment because of it, and that's broadly positive, but it's also got negative things as well.
I can feel that happening. We got like an IKEA hacker thing. Some guy in Germany sells 4 bits of wood in the exact shape that you can construct them such that you turn a standard IKEA chest of drawers turns the top into a baby changing thing.
Nice.
So we're potty trained now. We don't need nappies anymore.
There you go.
And we took it off and I threw it away. Yeah. And I went, oh my God, I've unscrewed. I remember building that. Yeah. That's been 5 years.
I can't tell you how liberating that felt to me. Like all of those things that you're always wistful about.
Yeah.
Bagging stuff up into the charity shop and never having to look at anything made by VTech again is so liberating.
As someone took our pram away, I gave it the finger. I hated it that much.
Tom Price and Stuart Goldsmith. They will return for more next year. And they both do excellent podcasts, which you should listen to as well. I've linked to them both on our website. Stuart's is The Comedian's Comedian, in which he interviews top names in comedy about their technique. Recent guests on that include Russell Kane, Rosie Jones, and Greg Jenner. And Tom's podcast is called My Mate Bought a Toaster, in which celebrity guests reveal to him their Amazon shopping histories. Guests coming up include Les Dennis and Annika Rice. And if you look through the archive, a certain Mr. Ollie Mann has also contributed to that show as well. It's a fun episode. Do check it out. Right, so that is it for this year's Dad Chat. But before I let Stuart go, there was something else I had to ask him. Do you know who Terry Pedestrian is?
Sort of person I would know.
Well, I'm going to play you a bit of something, Stuart, and you tell me if it rings any bells. It's a song that Teddy Pedestrian and The Crossing have written. It is called Driving Music for You, open brackets, if you are Stuart Goldsmith, close brackets. Have you stumbled across this before, Stu?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I know what this is.
What is it?
It's called keyword spamming. I'm a keyword, and this guy has an album of songs for people. And if you look on the album, there's 99 other songs,
right.
And they're all the names of similarly profiled comedians.
Yes,
me.
I'm on it. That's how I found it.
yeah. So it's called keyword spamming, and I mean, I half am annoyed by it and think it's ludicrous, and half of me is like, I mean, nice hustle. You've got to put the work in to make the hustle
work. Come
on. So. There's an article about it. This guy realized that people constantly search for things. So if you create things that they search for, you can get the money from a Spotify play because there are enough, and there are arguably not in my case, I mean, but there are arguably enough people out there who would recognize my name and go, cool, that's odd. And if you multiply that by releasing 1 million songs, you can make an income off Spotify.
What?
So the songs are 90 seconds long.
But Rick Astley doesn't make enough money out of Spotify. Are you honestly telling me that this guy does by monetizing your and my names?
Mate, I know a comedian I won't name who plays his own records on Spotify constantly in the background silently and makes $70 a month.
Thank you for explaining it, though, because I genuinely didn't know what I've been speculating. Like, how has this happened?
Yes. I'm sorry. It's a slightly boring answer that it's keyword spamming. But like I said, half of me sort of resents it. And I'm like, get my name out your mouth, you con artist. And half of me is like, yeah, nice hustle, buddy. Nice hustle.
So now you know. Keyword spamming. So fascinating. If you have an insight like that into like the secret ways that the internet works, I'm always on the lookout for stories like that. Do get in touch. Drop us a line via the feedback form on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Still to come, a sex worker with performance anxiety. It can only be the foxhole. But first, just a reminder that this show, this production that you are enjoying with your ears, it's free to download. It is not free to produce. We paid Tom and Stu for that contribution, can you believe? we need microphones. We need tech subscriptions. We have travel expenses. And of course, we put our time and our energy into making this for you. We are a completely independent production. We are not backed by any startup cash or corporations or oligarchs. We rely on you to support this show. So if you enjoy it and you want us to keep making it for you every month, please do buy us a beer. On a monthly basis, if you can, all your contributions go into making the show. Details of how to make us a secure payment are on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. And here's a quick roll call of honour for some of the Man fans who've recently donated for the first time. Jamie Slater, Tim Griffith, Owen Gould, Aaron Dooley in Denver, Colorado, Elizabeth McEwen, Mark Chapman, James Evans, who's updated his beer money contributions from yearly to monthly, hallowed be his name, Alex in Iceland, Judy, and Chris Ashton, a dog walker and formerly a project manager in the electronics industry. You're all incredible people. Thank you. Join them, support us, modernman.co.uk, click beer money. Right, Alex is up next. After this. Time to get your fox off. It's The Foxhole with Alex Fox.
Hello. Yes, you're back with your favourite boffin when it comes to all things banging.
What's been going on in the world of Alex?
Well, actually, I have in my hands right now a book which I only received yesterday, so I haven't read it yet. But it's a novel called The Service that has been written by my fabulous friend Frankie Mirren. It centres around three women. And Frankie has told me that one of the side characters is actually loosely based on me.
Oh, well, you'll know which one it is because it will be the one with bright pink hair that's wearing a pyjama suit.
Maybe it'll just be the one who's great at puns.
Time for your questions of sex, brought to you by our friends at thehandy.com.
Who make one of the most masterful masturbation machines on the market.
And it's from George, who is a gay male in his 30s, who says, I was a sex worker at university, and now I have trouble disassociating from the performance parts of sex and just letting go to enjoy it. Any advice?
I have received an influx of messages and questions from people who have entered sex work recently. There's a lot more people doing things like OnlyFans or providing webcam services. Lots of people have turned to that over the past year because of the pandemic.
That's really interesting because when you say sex work and, you know, from George's email, brief as it is, we assume you're talking about a physical hands-on act with someone. But actually now sex work can just mean, like everyone else, working from home, using webcams.
Yeah, people have different definitions of it. Some people include stripping, for example, others don't. But there are definitely forms of sex work which are online only, but still involve very intimate, yes, personal sexual acts, and some which are in person. I think George's message implies in-person work too. But just this week, I heard from another guy who says that he's doing online dom work, and he too is really struggling with the impact that that's having on his natural personal encounters. He told me he'd started expecting time limits that weren't there, so he was he started to kind of watching the clock, expecting that somebody's half hour will be up soon. He's been starting to consciously think, oh, what have I done previously that this person has enjoyed, and very much treating them like a client. If you do any type of sex work, there is a possibility that there'll be some crossover from your professional life into your personal life.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, George uses the word performance. You know, I'd go further and say if you do any kind of performance work, there's a chance it could bleed over into your other life. I mean, I often find myself sitting down and chatting to someone and feeling a bit like I'm interviewing them. Like there's parts of my brain that's thinking, what do the audience want to know? I'm like, what am I doing? I'm just having a chat with them in real life. I don't need to worry about what the audience want to know.
Well, you make a really good point there, which is echoed by Kitty Stryker, who is a 37-year-old woman who's worked in the sex industry for about 14 years. Some of this was in-person sex work. So she did pro domination. She was an escort. She did live sex shows on stage. And then she moved into porn. She's now, like George, stepped back from sex work. And one of the things that she said that she finds kind of useful is to realise that that performative nature of sex, that experience of feeling like you have to perform in the bedroom, that impression is not unique to one's experience of sex work. Lots of people perform in the bedroom. It's something that's societally tied into sexuality and sexual experience for a lot of people.
It can be easier, can't it? To suddenly get into playing the part of being horny is easier than sort of remaining entirely authentic the whole way through.
Well, there are elements of performance which can be fun to indulge. You know, it can be enjoyable to take on a role or to do something knowing that it will impress or turn on your partner.
Yeah.
But it is really important to make this distinction between performing that you're leaning into because you're genuinely enjoying it, or performance that you are trying to live up to because it's a learned behaviour or something that society has told you that you need to do.
But then there's probably some things that is still useful to do. I mean, faking an orgasm is the one that comes to mind. I suppose there are some people that think, yes, this is performative, yes, this isn't authentic, but because it's pleasing my partner, it is worth doing. It's better that I do that than don't do it.
I would argue that faking an orgasm in almost every scenario has a detrimental effect on your sex life, certainly in the long term, because it creates a really destructive feedback loop where your partner will believe that what you're pretending works for you is actually genuinely turning you on, so they'll do more of it. Being as authentic as possible in your personal love life will benefit absolutely everybody. And that's certainly something that George sounds like he aspires to. So to try and help him with that, I spoke to a spectacular guy called Jason Domino. His story is that he actually started sex work because he wanted to make some money to support his partner who needed therapy for a mental health issue. So it was a real compassionate reason why he got into sex work. He went from doing escorting to porn. One of the first recommendations that Jason made is connect with the community, including other people who've left sex work, so that George feels like there are spaces where he can talk about his past without there being any shame, and to people who will understand the feelings that he's experiencing and the scenarios that he finds himself in now. Good places that he might want to check out in the UK: Swarm, the Sex Worker Advocacy and Resistance Movement. In Ireland, there's Sway, Sex Worker Alliance Ireland. In Scotland, there's Umbrella Lane. The Red Umbrella has actually become a bit of an icon, a symbol for sex workers. If you're outside the UK, looking into the Decrim Now movement, or even just searching the hashtag Decrim Now, is a great way to find organisations and community groups in your area.
But what kind of thing are they likely to be able to tell him?
Well, they might say things a lot like Jason did to me, which is one thing that he has found helpful with his partners who are not clients are to do things sexually with them that wouldn't happen in a client sex worker environment. For example, he found it really helpful to use a blindfold because handing over that much power and trust to another person would very rarely happen. If somebody was had hired you. And also that can help you really connect physically again with your body. I mean, this is something that we've spoken about in completely different scenarios, but sometimes taking away your sense of vision, if you feel safe and comfy with that, can help you hone in on what you're really feeling in your body and can reconnect you with the actual sensations that you're feeling.
I mean, again, we've talked about this in other scenarios as well, simple things like changing the room that you're in the house. But I mean, if the place where you do your sex work looks more like a bedroom, maybe don't have sex in the bedroom for a while.
Jason also spoke about using different forms of social capital to seduce your real life lover.
What does that mean?
It's a complicated concept, but it's essentially about valuing yourself and learning to recognize that you are lovable and worthwhile even when you're not performing, even when you're not using the attributes that you have that you would have used to attract clients.
It sounds like, so might that mean actually not going to bed so soon? Might it mean a return to sort of courtship for a while?
Yeah, it might. It might mean dating. Kitty said for her, the experience that she'd had in porn often required her to wear sexy lingerie, have her nails done, have very particular makeup. In her case, she had to make sure that it was moisture proof so she didn't sweat it off, or it didn't, you know, her lipstick didn't disappear with spunk or whatnot. And she found that being more comfy with her natural body, letting her body hair grow out a bit, feeling more confident that her partner would still desire her if she hadn't dolled herself up, letting someone see her in her natural state and realizing that she was still considered a desirable person, it helped her to realize that people didn't only want her when she was advertising herself in that way.
I think that can be more attractive for the long-term partner as well, actually. Like, you know, feeling that you're getting someone's authentic self when they're not trying is sexy in itself, isn't it? Not to say that someone really trying to be your fantasy isn't sexy, but equally someone who is just themselves is in itself an attractive thing, I think.
Absolutely. And let's talk about George's partner's attitude. Because even somebody who tries to be switched on, a decent, there are so many deeply embedded misunderstandings, misinterpretations, and frankly stigmas about both sex workers and also gay people. There's a real double whammy of difficulty that George is facing here. Not to blame his partner, but both he and his lover might be holding quite a lot of shame or a lot of preconceived ideas about what his sex work history means about him as a person. Exploring that together and realizing that some of the ideas that they might hold in their head are actually not true could be a really valuable experience. Doing sex work in college is not an uncommon story. And as Jason points out, he made the very good point that in a lot of cases, arguably the majority, the reason that people do sex work in such circumstances is to protect themselves or their loved ones, for example, from debt. And there is nothing dishonourable in that. I get the sense from George's message that he holds so much regret and shame and disappointment and sadness about himself. And actually reassessing his past, stopping beating himself up about that, I think could do his, not only his love life, but his whole life a lot of good.
Fascinating stuff. Well, good luck with that, George. I hope that helped. If you have a question of sex for Alex Fox to answer here on The Foxhole on The One Man, what do you have to do with it?
Well, there isn't a lot of sexy work involved in this, because all you need to do is go to modmanwith2ns.co.uk and hit feedback.
And our thanks to The Handy for sponsoring The Foxhole.
One thing I must point out about The Handy is when I describe like this ultimate hand job fucking machine for guys, you might imagine something really explicit, but it's actually pretty subtle as well as being sensual.
Right? It looks pretty. It looks like a Sonos speaker.
And you can find out more about it at thehandy.com, where if you use the voucher code FOXHOLE, F-O-X-H-O-L-E, then we'll sort you out with free express shipping.
So go and treat yourself to the masturbation toy for men. Go to thehandy.com. And thanks again to them. Alex, thanks very much. See you next time.
Cheers, my dears.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this episode, but there is just time to appoint a new manbassador. It is Gabe Onkiko from the Philippines, who says, Ollie, here are my credentials. One, I'm a musical theatre kid like you. Two, back in college, the Answer Me This albums were the first MP3s I ever legally downloaded. And three, in my proudest advice-giving moment, I channeled Alex to assuage my devoutly Christian friend's fears about having sex after her upcoming marriage. Her church titas were warning her it would hurt, so God pointed her to me, her one queer friend. And I told her, communication, foreplay, lube. Gabe, what can I say? You are ready to be our ambassador for the Philippines. Congratulations. Until next time, our theme is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. And we'll see you with something new on the 10th of July.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.